Welcome to The B-Side, a sociology podcast on the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, materiality, and much more. The B-Side is a sociocast production. For more, visit sociocast.org. We're your hosts,
Corey Fields
and Leslie Hinkson. So, each episode, we invite a guest on to talk about their work and its impact on their academic field. And then we ask that guest to engage in discussion on two topics of interest in current events. The first relates in some way to their areas of research and expertise. And the second topic, which we're calling, I know you didn't ask me, but, is our op-ed section. And that is because we ask our guests to weigh in on topics that they have opinions about, because even though they are experts, right, in some things, that does not mean that they should not be allowed to be intelligent people with their own ideas and opinions about very important events in our life and culture.
If we ask you to come on the show, you're an expert in everything. What can't you talk about?
Yes. Well, you're an expert in one thing and a potential thought leader in something else. How about
nice.
So today's guest is John Eason. John is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. His most recent book is Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2017. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Corey and Leslie, I really appreciate this. As always, it's great to chat with y'all.
Yeah, you're one of our favorites.
I know. Had to have you.
Yeah. So, John, before we get to your work, we asked you to pick an A-side track for this episode. What did you pick and why?
I picked Get Outlined by Black Thought on Streams of Thought, Volume 2. Black Thought, I think, right now is probably the most underappreciated but best rapper to me. I think he can speak to not just the old man crew like myself, but he has, I think his voice and his flow transcends generations. So I think he'll be appreciated even more in the future. So he also has a great line on there about rising from rock bottom to be one of the top scholars, which I think it sort of serves as my theme song for when I want to get hyped to really do my work.
I know. It sounds like you maybe already been in Madison too long if you're talking about Black Thought as underrated. But we are a podcast that endorses Black Thought. We are all down with rappers for the washed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And John, I actually think that that's actually a great A-side selection to get us started talking about your most recent work.
Yeah, I really appreciate you guys giving me a chance to talk through this because it's always good not just to be able to talk, but to listen to really smart folks that have an informed opinion and can look at things from a very different perspective. So given each of your work, the type of work you do, not only your approach theoretically, but just your opinion and given this form as well, I'm actually trying to put more of a public face as I work on my second and third book projects. So one book project that I'm really not going to touch on much today is around ending ICE and really pushing to end immigrant detention. But that's part of it's related directly to the second book I'm working on around prison building. And it's tentatively entitled In Our Backyards, How the Prison Boom Transformed Rural America, or America, I should say, How the Prison Boom Transformed America. And I don't know where to start with this one. I'm actually in the middle of reorganizing the chapters as I write them, as I do the empirical analyses for them. This is more of a quantitative book, which is going to be a departure from my first book, which was an ethnography. But all of the quantitative analysis are basically, I'm testing things that I have from my first book. And I think theories I developed in my first book, but I think the real point of tension now is whether or not I'm going to do it thematically, or as you guys know, mm-hmm. writing books, or how much chronology matters. Mm-hmm. And so the 1619 project, as I've leafed through that, I've skimmed it a couple of times, read deeper into some portions, but it's kind of this one quote by Matt Desmond has sort of stuck in my craw, in terms of if you want to understand the violence of prisons today, you have to start with the brutality of slavery. And that sort of, I think that speaks to how time and space get condensed when we start talking about race and racism. Mm-hmm. And I think what 1619 has done has acknowledged racial inequity, the convergence of racial and economic inequity, and put a public face on it. But also in that conversation, has been really keen on highlighting the accomplishments of Black folks. So there's a part I'm forgetting. I think this is the main journalist where she talks about, for the most part, Black Americans fought back alone. She's pointing to the systems of racial and economic oppression from slavery to Jim Crow and the like. But she says, yet we never fought only for ourselves. The bloody freedom struggles of the civil rights movements laid the foundation for every other modern rights struggle. I've heard some buzz, like critiques of who is the audience, the New York Times Magazine, who's the main audience in the New York Times Magazine. And, you know, are Black folks just kowtowing to white liberals again and telling them stories they want to hear? And maybe they should have went to history class. Or maybe we should properly educate folks. So there's all of that salt, you know. And I'm a well-known curmudgeon. I think I'm officially registered with the Curmudgeon Society of America. So I can feel some of that. But at the same time, it's not very. People are where they are, and we don't get the not just politicians, but the business leaders that we have today, without a certain level of ignorance.
And well, okay. Well, since you introduced the 1619 Project, maybe we should talk about the 1619 Project now, right? And so just to sort of give those of our listeners who have no idea what the 1619 Project is for some reason or the other, it's an initiative, coming out of the New York Times, which was spearheaded by Nicole Hannah Jones, basically observing the 400th anniversary of the introduction of the North Atlantic slave trade in what would become the United States. And I think I think that this initiative is doing two types of labor, right? So it's meant to force us to re-examine the legacy of slavery in the United States, by at the same time centering the founding of this nation not upon the adoption of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, but on the date that the first 20 or so enslaved Africans were brought to shore in the Virginia colony, right? And so, like, this is, I think, what the project as a whole is meant to do. And so, John, you introduced, some of the salt that's out there, or some of the shade that people are throwing on the 1619 Project. Corey, why don't we just start with the critiques? Because that's the total opposite of what we do in sociology. We usually start with the strengths. So let's, let's go the other way. Let's start focusing on some of the critiques and then, talk about some of the positives.
Okay, so the critiques that have been leveled against it. I mean, because I feel like So it's interesting. I've heard less in terms of critiques from the left. I mean, John sort of intimated that there was sort of like a, who is the audience for this, and like who needs this, and is this just again something of where like Black people are having to educate white people and have to talk about Blackness in a way that sits comfortably with white people, with, something I think about a lot. But actually, it's it's surprisingly, I've had less exposure to those left critiques. I've been sort of hearing more from the right, where people are kind of like, you know, stop making America seem bad, and like, it's, you know, it wouldn't be America if it weren't for slavery, and sort of efforts to undermine the overall intellectual project, which it's funny because when I think about it in relationship to the critique from the left that John was talking about, it kind of articulated this thing that really, like, the complaints from the right feel a little hollow, because I feel like you're always hearing like, well, it's about, you know, reaching out and making things accessible to people who don't understand. And like, you know, you should do more to win people over to your cause. And I feel like the whole 1619 Project is really this entirely good faith effort to make these sort of very forthright, like, you may not have known this, but here's some insight and research to show you, you know, how racism structures all these facets of American life from like slavery on, how slavery became this sort of defining institution of American society as we know it. And so it's actually this, I mean, I sort of saw it as this really well-meaning outreach effort to sort of, you know, like, educate and explain. It's kind of like, this why we so mad, you know, like, without saying this is why we so mad.
Without yelling at you, I'm mad, right? Because that's the alternative. Because like I said, I had a little bit of that at first. Of course, it was flooding my Facebook feed and Twitter feed. But then I also started hearing some of the critiques before I started really reading through it. And then I saw people who I knew, who I know, who were writing for it. So I was like, okay, let me be a little more open to actually hearing what they're saying. And it's not only what they were saying, I think it's how they were saying it. And the fact that I've lived in states like Texas, where they, you know, my son, who's, you know, I'm always bragging on him apparently, but he had to go through school in Arkansas, Texas, and Arizona. Okay.
Oh, there
Texas,
you go.
Yeah. And there you go. And you wonder why I'm bragging on him, because he had to suffer under some of the, like, they aren't teaching the white kids in these states, right? Mm-hmm. And we were in rural communities sometimes too, or exurban communities. And their idea of even Texas history, you know, they had gym teachers. You don't have to be a certified teacher to teach gym. They taught Texas history. For his seventh grade history course, the dude had to make a pros and cons list for Jefferson Davis versus Lincoln, right?
Both sides. Find people on both sides.
Find people on both sides. In the seventh grade Texas history course, he had them watch Gone with the Wind as a movie on for the slavery unit. That was their slavery unit, okay? So when you actually have children and you see how miseducated, it's not just Black folks, we are miseducated as a country, then you can say, oh, the New York Times is doing basically a PSA for those of you who did not get this, or the fact that they changed the textbooks to write slavery out of history because of states like Texas. So I think this, you're absolutely right, Corey. This was the fact that I heard the left critique, and there are right people on the far right who are still like, well, why do we need this? Because obviously you didn't get it. Right. Or you wouldn't be asking these basic questions.
I mean, one of the things that I find so fascinating about, you know, that primary critique that you noted, John, about, well, who's the audience of the New York Times? You know what I mean? I think that there are a lot of people out there who are well-educated or relatively well-educated who think they know everything about everything, right? Yeah. And I think the 1619 Project actually caused a lot of those people, and I'm talking about people of all colors, right? I'm talking people of all backgrounds from across the country, caused people to actually pause and say, hey, actually, I didn't learn this, right?
Right.
Or I didn't learn this. I mean, I mentioned on you know, on an episode of The Annex this season, that when I went to the National Museum of African American History and Culture, like I think it was the first or second week that it had opened, I didn't learn very much from the exhibits. Okay. I didn't learn very much from those exhibits. I mean, like that stuff that like I purposely like studied myself, right? And so I got that a lot of. So I didn't learn very much from the exhibits, but I learned a whole lot from watching the other people in the museum interact with the exhibits. And I'm talking about people from all backgrounds, right? And it was shocking to me how little almost all of the people who I was, you know, walking around with and, you know, for hours, how little they actually knew. So, I mean, I kind of feel like some people want to flex and be like, oh, we already know all that, right? I was like, well, good for you if you know all that. But you know what? You don't know how many other people out there don't know it. And a lot of those people happen to be Black.
I mean, I think it's also like in some ways where we talk about who's the audience for this. I think I haven't seen any data on this. So I essentially just talking outside of my neck. But I'm almost certain that I'm going to be correct here when data does appear. But that this probably the 1619 Project is drawing from a much wider audience than the New York Times normally gets.
Exactly.
So I feel like there are people reading this who don't normally read the New York Times. And I mean, so like the Black folks I know, like the Black folks from home who are into it, it's like for them, it operates almost in like the same way my mama got all these newspapers from when Obama was elected president and like, and you know, magazines and stuff of like, we got to keep the history.
Right,
it's
sort
of a similar kind of thing of like, oh, this is our history. Like, you know, it embedded in these sort of like national institutions. And so I want to have this because like it never happened. They're never telling our full story or they're only telling, you know, so-and-so got arrested or whatever, but like to have a newspaper, an important newspaper covering this is like, you know, this massive story in this special edition. Like, I want to keep that as like a memento. So I think, you know, some of like that is happening and that matter. I think that's, you know, that kind of representation is still certainly important. I definitely feel like, there's, you know, certainly like an educational thing happening where I think probably even the sort of centrist to lefty liberal audience of the New York Times needs to know, and that doesn't really think about, you know, the connection between U.S. politics, U.S. economy, just the day-to-day life in the U.S. that's sort of grounded in the fact that, you know, this was a slave state. You know, the state of the United States was a slave state.
Well, yeah, no, we talk about it even in the academy. And I'm not just picking on legal scholars because we also we could talk all day about how we conceptualize race outside of normal things. So in legal scholarship, they say these are extra race is an extra legal thing. Mm-hmm. Not if the law itself is racist. I don't
right.
know, like the laws are racist. So how is it extra legal unless you're like using it as some type of euphemism, like extra, like that, you know, how we use extra in the last 10, 15 years. So I don't understand that unless we're just trying to minimize race all the time, which we are. It's either through certain people's lenses, it's either like blown out of proportion or other folks, it's like a funhouse mirror, how we talk about race. So, and that's why I think is any public education campaign around making us more literate and open to talk about race and racism in particular, I have to applaud, right? Even though the inner curmudgeon in me, the academic, the guy who sees himself as the scholar, we should know this, but I'm amazed at what scholars don't know, right? So what we don't know about our own fields and how we, and that's why this project has attracted me.
Yeah, I mean, I think to that point, I was sort of struck by, you know, social media conversations like on Twitter and Instagram and whatnot, where people were sort of, Black people were sort of like, yeah, I didn't learn, you know, in high school, like, we didn't even hardly talk about slavery. The slavery section of my school was like showing Gone with the Wind. Like people, you know,
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe this is like a cohort effect, but it kind of made me think like, damn. And I preface this by saying I unquestionably went to a super shitty high school, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it was like, you know, racial segregation in Memphis. Like, it was this all black high school, smallish. I remember thinking in high school, like, this place seems shitty. I don't feel like I'm getting the best education.
Yeah. Because you don't know no better. Right.
Right. Well, but now you I do. Right. But, yeah. But it was like, you know, the history teacher, who, by the way, was also a coach, Coach Curry. but it's like, we did learn about slavery. And we talked about how, like, you know, slavery set the stage for what life was going to be like in the United States for both black people and white people. And so I'm not saying like the benefits of segregation, but I mean, I did kind of feel like it was surprising to me the extent to which, and it sort of reinforced how important something like this actually is, because it's like, oh, right. Like, this isn't something people are just picking up in school.
Exactly. So to that point, Corey, I have like 2 points. So number one, I went to one of the best public high schools in the country, and we hardly talked about slavery because obviously that wasn't important. And it wasn't an important part. You know, it's like, you know, the New York Regents, you know, wasn't the Regents exam wasn't going to test us on it. And, you know, and if we were taking APs, we were going to get very little on it. Right. So what's the friggin' point? Right. Because these schools are in some ways like, you know, they're just like, all we really care about is how many people we place in top colleges and universities. Right. Yeah. Number one, but also number two, and thinking about this as, you know, sort of a public education project. One of the other things that is pretty exciting about the 1619 project is it also provides, you know, like school material, like curricula to go along with this, to be right. Like, hey, you know, if you're on board, you know, with thinking that this is something that it is that's important and that we should be speaking to our kids about and that we should be finally incorporating into American history, right? As part of what this nation was and is, right? You need to be teaching this, and this is how you teach it. And I think that's another thing that's very valuable about this project.
No, definitely. I mean, I guess in hindsight, I have to look back and say, you know, thank you, Coach Curry. You most certainly could not teach an AP history class, but you did make sure we knew that slavery was super fucked up and the basis of which of like much of our policing system, because that was his thing. He would always be like, look at the police. It grew out of slavery. And I was like, okay. Right.
So when you trace the historical story, when you trace the history, so the stories are important, right? All of those stories, I mean, even KRS-One talks about overseer becoming officer, right?
Yeah.
They both ride on horses, all of those things, right? Show my age with that. But yeah, so you have all of those direct links that you can see rhetorically. And that's actually, I want to keep talking about 1619, but I did want to talk about my current research and how it's centered.
Yes.
And how I'm actually... So it's really trippy because we have all of these rhetorical sort of tricks where we're looking at slavery or Jim Crow. Vince Staples says, Connie Bus, slave ship, same shit, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, that's an easy rhetorical trick for a rapper to make.
Yeah.
But should we be that conceptually loose as scholars when we're in the academy? Because if we level that easily, we also deny the voice of Black folks that have triumphed over these past systems of racial oppression. Not to say slavery, not to say mass incarceration isn't a system of racial oppression, but it's not the same as Jim Crow, and it's not the same as slavery. And not to say, oh, it's better, you know, than slavery or Jim Crow, because there's some slaves that didn't have it as bad as some people have it in prison today, right? So on average, though, all of them are fairly terrible, right? And they disproportionately affect Black people. I think for us, naming it, sociologists in particular, naming it is important. So there hasn't even been, and this is why I said I'm struggling, because I'm in the middle of writing, I did these couple of public pieces, the Descent piece on, which is basically a recap of my first book on how the rise of the rural ghetto led to prison building in this one town and how Black people participated in that willingly, including the head of the NAACP, local chapter of the NAACP, but also trying to look back and forward. So trying to look back, and this is where the 1619 Project weaves in too. Kevin Cruz is looking at a traffic jam in Atlanta and looking at infrastructure. And there are a couple of other pieces, I can't name them all, where they're looking at the political economy of place and link back to slavery. So the modern political economy of place, which includes the infrastructure, geography, and the like, mm-hmm. and how prison, not how prison, how slavery has a historic, the history is alive today because it shapes what's going on now, right? But with prisons, we sort of leveled it and we conflated all slavery, Jim Crow, all of it's the same thing as prisons. You know, people have gone as far to say the late great Chrisman said that all Black people that are incarcerated are political prisoners, right? And even testing our notion of linked fate. So how much are we going to go to the mattresses for Black folks that are incarcerated, right? Or are we the ones that put them there? When nobody wants to talk about those. Nobody wants to have those uncomfortable conversations, let alone whether or not, you know, we've actively participated in prison building, right? Or the fact that 450,000 corrections officers is more than 400,000. I think it's about 450,000. And the last good count on corrections officers, about 22% of them were Black, right? So when you start throwing that stuff around to people, you know, it gets very, very dicey and complicated not only about racism, but how race plays out when you're dealing with these complicated things. And you can't incarcerate over 2 million people. You can't build more than 1,100 prisons. And you can't have something that takes up a landmass almost, you know, half the size of the state of Rhode Island and employs as many people as it does and not have it affect all people, not just white people, or white people just benefit from it. Black people suffer, brown people suffer from prisons, but their communities also benefit from it. And I think that's the real struggle of trying to tell this story and relating it back to slavery. So I think I sent you guys something on the political, I sent you guys two or three different things, but one of them is about the political economy of place from plantation. What did I call it? That's a presentation I did at ASA. From plantation to prison or something like that, where I look at the proportion of slaves mm-hmm. in 1860 in a county, and I look at the probability of building a prison in the modern era. And that, of course, it's a correlate, right? The proportion of slaves doesn't predict, but it's a correlation with prison building post 1970.
Hmm. Well, you know, I think that kind of goes to, you know, that Mark Twain quote, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. So making that false equivalence of like prison being slavery, yeah. right? Yeah. It's not that it is slavery, but it rhymes. It's a correlate, right? And I think that that's actually a great point that you bring up, John, about us being very, very careful about the ways in which we either call things, you know, equals to each other, right? You know, they're concepts that we can equate, or they're systems that we can equate. And what I think actually 1619 does, it says, look, it's not the same thing, but without this, we wouldn't have this thing.
Yep. It does. It links all of these things together. So that's actually, that's why I've been sort of enthralled with it, because I start reading it and it actually gets me, it's one of the few times I can jot down notes and write a little, because it's really drawing on a lot of things, even my own family history. So I think in the first, one of the first stories where she talks about her dad flying the American flag, right? Mm-hmm. I think that really set home, that really stood out for me, because my wife's family is a military family. Her late grandfather fought in both Korea and Vietnam, and they called him Sarge, right? He passed a couple of years ago, but he was still known as Sarge. Everybody called it, his wife may have called him Sarge on occasion, right? But, you know, my grandfather, conversely, fought in World War II, and he was like, don't ever join the military. That ain't no place for Black people. You know, he's one of them people. Like, yeah, the military, they made me a sergeant because I could read. You know, he was just he's like, the Black people in the military were the worst, right? My grandfather could also be a stunt double for Uncle Ruckus, but that's a whole that's a whole other story. But yeah, it's the I think it's bringing out all the contradictions over time of being free in America, and with that, how freedom isn't evenly distributed. It's not an evenly distributed resource, or even the ability to think free, right? Think freely and think of what you could be.
But I am interested in sort of, I think I understood that you're making of sort of you feeling like you have to be cautious in drawing links between the development of sort of the prison industrial complex and sort of the history of slavery in the U.S. Not that the book that you're working on is sort of directly about that link, but this idea that you don't see it as like a direct continuous path from one to the other necessarily, or am I misunderstanding?
No, I think in my first book, I pushed back against that notion because, and I didn't know it at the time, I'm trying to articulate it now. Mm-hmm. Slavery was slavery and we beat it.
Okay.
Black folks beat it, right? You had convict leasing, right? That's where we get the disproportionate rate of incarceration that exists until today. And you know what? We survived convict leasing. We survived Reconstruction. And we dismantled Jim Crow. We took on Jim Crow. That's what followed that, right? We're trying to survive in the ghettos, even though there's gentrification, everything else going on. If we understand these all as types of racial exploitation, if we understand these systems as, if you want to call them racial projects, mm-hmm. a la Omi and Wanat, racialized social systems, EBS, call them what you want. They've morphed over time, but they're also, there have been social movements against all of these different facets of racial dominance. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to point to, I've outgrown my grad student, just straight hateration stuff, right? I'm not trying to do an advocacy dance. I'm not trying to say I need to raise awareness about this. I'm trying to shape a research agenda which informs policy.
Okay.
So one thing we haven't really asked, we talk about mass incarceration of 2.3 million people annually, 2.3 million people annually denied their freedom, but we don't talk about the prison boom or the buildup from about 400 or 500 prisons to about 1,600 to 1,700 and that relationship. What came first, the chicken or the egg? The prison boom or mass incarceration? And we can look at this, I'm in the middle of doing the analysis on this across each state and looking over time. There were some states that were sued, like California, because they had overcrowding issues. So they had to build more prisons. That wasn't the case everywhere. And most of the prison building in this country took place in the South. Mm-hmm. They weren't being sued at the same rate as some other states. They just built out and filled them.
Right.
Right. And so what I'm trying to do in this book and in papers that I'm writing that will be built into this book is really examine that relationship and tease it out. Because it's not going to be the same in every state. Mm-hmm. But we need to understand if we're going to try and make, if we're going to do, if we're going to have collective action in some way, it has to be based on an empirical reality.
So, John, when you talk about the prison boom, are you talking primarily about the building of public prisons or private prisons?
So they're only about 13% of all prisons are private. Mm-hmm. So I'm mainly talking about state facilities. So Texas, for example, has 120 prisons. 10 of them or 12 of them are private, right? And they built a bunch of these during the 90s. One year, I think it was 94 or 95. I want to say I'm forgetting the exact number, but it's 25 or 30. They opened 25 or 30 prisons, right? Mm-hmm. Which is just a little ridiculous, even for Texas. So, and that's a public works project. And that was primarily, when you look at the map, you can go to my site, johneason.com, and under the prison proliferation link, you can look on the map. It's a lot of places along the border. Right. Mm. A lot of towns that have high percentages of Latinx folks got prisons as a public works project. So it's really it's not about the private industry dominating prisons. If we're talking about immigrant detention, that's a whole other discussion. And that's like a human rights. I've been screaming that's a human rights issue for at least 3 or 4 years since getting some data around that. That's a whole other issue. And that system is not nearly as large as the prison system. So I think the work I'm trying to put forward, I come out of advocacy or out of community organizing, really. That's how I came into the academy. We weren't being smart enough or thoughtful enough in our campaigns, and we needed better analysis. And that's why I came into the academy. I think there's advocacy, which is raising awareness about an issue, which the New York Times 1619 Project does. I think that's great for people to do that. I think it's great when scholars bring our attention, and even with rhetorical or hyperbolic ways of talking about mass incarceration, prison building, or prisons and prisoner reentry, whatever the issue is, where the intersection of race and punishment lie. I think advocacy is great, but I think I'm more of a practical, solution-oriented person. So I'm trying to ask good heart research questions that can easily turn into policy.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I asked the question public versus private is because, you know, with private industry, I get it. Lots of times you build things just due to sheer speculation, right? And you're like, we think this is what the market, right? But we have no idea. But, you know, the whole concept is if you build it, they will come, mm-hmm. right? With public works, on the other hand, right, there's something else going on that's driving, right, the building of these facilities. So what is that other thing?
So I joke about this, which is, you know, people don't always get it, but, you know, you guys know me well enough. To go through an RFP, request for a proposal from the government, to oversimplify, prison building is racist. We are literally living in Nazi Germany because they're the only ones who want that level of efficiency and documentation when they're doing something that wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why Hitler is like the Michael Jordan of racism, right? And he's the worst at that, right? He's the worst. He's the best at being the worst for a reason. When you have an RFP in process and folks have to apply and rationalize and justify why they want something. They give a whole bunch of reasons, but based on my ethnography, a little more than a year in rural Forest City, Arkansas, named after the founder of the KKK, Nathan Bedford Forrest. I mean, the town was so hyperbolic, it could be called racist town, right? But I didn't believe that the white folks that sat in the back room who decided to go after a prison, who also marshaled Black people in on this, marshaled a campaign and included some Black leaders in on this. I don't think they were overtly racist. They were actually, their town was in such disrepair, the reputation of it, that they were trying to save their town. So you have to really ask yourself, what's going on in these places and in the rural South, where your town is in such bad shape that you're going after a hideous institution like a prison to improve the reputation, right? And so that's, I think there's other racism that's happened further upstream. And I'm trying to test that out in a new book, in a new project.
So quick question, John. I mean, this probably speaks more to the first project, although it seems like it's probably related to what you're working on now. Now, when places like the town is sort of saying, we want to build a prison, is there like an internal understanding that like, this sucks because who wants to be a prison town, but this is our best shot? Or is it like, this is going to be great? Like, we're going to get a prison.
It's both. It's both. Okay. It depends on who they're talking to.
Okay.
So they frame it different ways. There's different frames they use. So sometimes they're like, oh, this is great. We're going to get all these other businesses. And then other times, folks would say stuff like, I had a guy say, well, if I could get a high tech industry that paid $100,000, you know, I would. I got the land. I'd sell it to him.
Right.
He said, but those places weren't exactly, he didn't even say just a high tech. I think he may have said something about a pollution free high tech industry. Mm-hmm. Right. So think Green New Deal. Right.
Right.
If those places were lining up, maybe they wouldn't need a prison. And that's more of what, yeah. So it depends on who's framing it when they were trying to sell it. And I'd come up with three different frames in the book where I talk about that. They frame it as a growth, like in terms of pro-growth, but also in terms of saving the town, the town's reputation, because they knew they couldn't get much else because they don't have the resources to attract other industries. So that's a real issue, right? And that's not just Forest City, Arkansas. That's rural America.
Right.
And you wonder why, you know, as I see we're at minute 43, but you wonder why they're voting for Trump. You wonder why, because this is like, these folks don't have much. He speaks their language. And if nobody is paying him any attention, and that's, you know, supposedly they're the forgotten man, but really it's white folks being in their feelings. I don't know how to say it. I've lived amongst them. It's just white folks being in their feelings.
Well, John, you have been the segue artist today, because that last sentence basically brings us right to our second topic of conversation today, which is, you know, our new segment called I Know You Didn't Ask Me But.
Maybe we're going to like rename into white folks being their feelings.
Yeah, perhaps, also known as.
Right.
Yeah. And Corey, I know you've been wanting to discuss this for some time.
Well, I feel like we kind of have to talk about it. It seems like, you know.
And what is this thing?
This thing is, I guess, what do we call it? Impeachment, right? Impeachment inquiry, maybe.
Yeah.
So we're taping this, the week of October 7th. And so right now we are in a situation where the White House has sent a letter to Congress essentially saying we aren't playing along. We aren't gonna cooperate with any of these investigations. The Department of Justice is instructing people not to participate in, you know, questioning. The State Department is not letting ambassadors testify to committees and whatnot. While at the same time, public support for impeachment inquiries is hovering at about like high 40s, 50% of people saying inquiry should happen. I think increasing numbers of people are saying removal from office should happen. So we're just kind of in Yeah, Impeachment City. And I guess I was just thinking, I don't know, B-side has to have an opinion on this, right?
Well, you know, I was saying, right, we were discussing this a little bit earlier, and in true scholarly fashion, I basically like drew a straight line comparing Donald Trump to the Joe Pesci character in Goodfellas, right? Right? I mean, just think about it, right? It's like the Joe Pesci character the entire time is acting like he's already made when he's not made. But you know what I mean? He fulfills this really important function for, you know, for the mob, right? Mm-hmm. He's a hitman. He's overly savage. People don't like it. He's crude, right? These are all the same things that we hear the Republicans saying about Trump, maybe not out loud, but behind closed doors. Yeah, you know, and you remember at some point in time, Joe Pesci crosses the line, right? And just when he thinks he's about to be made, he gets whacked, right?
Right.
I'm going to have to watch The Goodfellas again tonight to try and map out all the characters in this crazy play.
So I guess the question is like, has a line been crossed now that—
Or what is that line, right? What is that line? What does that line look like for Republicans to be like, yo, we gotta whack this guy, right? I mean, not literally, of course.
Yeah.
Is that the same line that he would have to cross for his base?
It's not clear to me what the line is. Although, to be fair, just this week, the removal of U.S. forces from Syria seems to have drawn a fair amount of rebuke from both the right and the left, actually. So maybe that, you know, this might be a line and that'll get connected to willingness to stand by him through these any sort of impeachment investigations. But I guess I wonder to what extent the question should be, what is it going to take for Republicans to cave? Because I think an answer might be they won't, actually. Like, you're never going to get enough Republican senators to flip and say, you know, he's done something impeachable for him to actually be impeached. But I'm not convinced that that should be an indicator that, like, the investigation should stop, that there shouldn't be, you know, impeachment proceedings. So, right. So, I can't tell you what the line is, right? It's someone who spends a little bit of time thinking about politics. I would have guessed the line would have been crossed a while back. I mean, it seems like it is.
Before he was elected.
Right, you would think, right. I mean, it
elected,
certainly seems like.
Nominated. I don't understand any of this.
Yeah. So it definitely seems like a short-term think. I mean, if you're like weighing the long-term prospects of the Republican Party, you would sort of have calculated this is not the move a while back. So I don't necessarily think there's going to be a flipping point where like droves of Republicans are walking away from him. I think what's maybe more likely is in general, the number of people who hand raise as Republicans sort of declines. But the people who say I'm a Republican at this point, they're sort of saying I'm pro-Trump, right? Like it's hard to sort of be like I'm Republican and be like, but I'm not with Trump. So I don't know if that's gonna move. But again, I wonder, is that the threshold for something has to be done?
I'd actually ask this question to you, Corey, because I'd be interested in how they're making any of the Black Republicans that you interviewed, if they've expressed any hesitancy, if you've gone back to chat with any of them. He's so hyperbolic and he's such a Hector projector,
right?
In terms of like even down to, this is a coup, right? He said,
right,
this is a coup last week and now he's pulling a coup. He's like trying to tell people, oh, like, I'm not fat. No, dude, you fat. We all see you eating a hamburger. You got chicken hanging out your mouth right now. And you on the scale and it says it's basically all the springs coming out the side and you saying you're not fat, right? But there's this hyperbole about him. He's so cartoonish. It's a dumpster fire on a railroad track being hit by a train with a car, and it's a 15 car pileup,
right?
Every day it's sensory overload every day, and he keeps saying it's nothing to see here. This is why, where we start with the 1619 project, I am unfazed by the depths of ignorance in this country. I think I don't know where our bottom is. These impeachment hearings will show us where our bottom is, because we're only as good as our weakest link. Mm-hmm. Right now, I don't see the floor. I mean, I thought we busted. We're through China right now, man, in terms of a moral bottom. Mm-hmm. We're on the other side. We're in the interstellar, whatever, on the other side of China. I don't know where Republicans are. I don't know how this dude got elected. I don't know how he got nominated. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, well, so I can't make it make sense. So I have no capacity to do that, because I too admit a little bit of a loss around this. I mean, the Black Republicans who still stay in touch with me are not at all sort of in Trump camp, right? They're sort of like, I identify as an independent now. Which is ironic because that was sort of their pathway into Republicanism, very frequently being like, I'm an independent. And then you become a Republican. There was this joke that they told me, you know, that a Black independent is just a Black Republican waiting to happen. But now the Black Republicans are all turning into independents. But that said, there's still, you know, there was just a conference this weekend, sort of Black Republicans or Black conservatives that was very pro-Trumpish. So there are always going to be a collection of folks who will sort of do the dance and stand by. What's interesting, I guess, is the extent to which, you know, that's sort of all the party has become in some ways. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess, yeah, it seems like we've talked a lot about Trump, but it'll be interesting to see how the Democrats in the House play this. Like, I'm assuming their approach is going to be foot on gas. I mean, this is about as over a barrel as they've had Trump. It would seem insane to dial it back at this point.
Yeah, I am sure we can keep talking about this for hours. And I wish we were all in the same place so we could have a couple of drinks or three or four or five, right? And continue this conversation.
Next time we have John on, it was like we will all have to have a few pre-drinks and then drinks in hand.
Yeah, I think we should all have a drink in hand. So you've been listening to The B-Side. Thanks to our guest, John Eason from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. John, thanks again.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Leslie. Thank you so much, Corey. I had a great time.
And we'd also like to thank our young producers at Queens College, Jaylene Colon and Lisette Moreno. Again, The B-Side is part of the growing Sociocast podcasting empire. And you can check out our sister programs at sociocast.org. Corey, you want to hit them up with the Twitter handle?
Yes, you can find us on Twitter at B-Side_podcast.
Signing out for The B-Side, for Corey Fields and Leslie Hinkson. To take us out, here's our B-Side pairing to John's A-Side selection, You Got Me by The Roots.
Bye.
Take care, y'all.
See you next time. Whatever, let's get together. Shit, you think not.